This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, powered by the Family Research Council, your embassy of faith, family, and freedom in the heart of our nation's capital. Now, here's your host, FRC President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Monday edition, this past weekend, I was presiding over a meeting of the Council for National Policy, which I also serve as president of. And one of the topics that was discussed was public education and how the left is advancing its agenda in the classrooms of America, where some 50 million of our children are being held captive. Now, maybe you know how bad it is, or maybe you don't. Now, some might say, well, it doesn't affect me. I don't have kids in the public schools, or my kids are graduated, or so on and so forth. Well, not so fast. Public education affects us all, and most of us are paying for it. Karen England, Executive Director of California's Capital Resource Institute, is here with unbelievable information about what is happening in the classroom. And you say, well, you know, I can't make a difference. Well, think again. Elizabeth Schultz, a frustrated parent who decided to run for the school board and has now been elected twice to Fairfax County School Board in Virginia, which, by the way, is the nation's 10th largest school district. She's here with us as well. And even Hollywood is getting in on the act. We'll be joined by Sam Sorbo, radio host, actress, author, wife, mother, and homeschooling advocate. Her time in Hollywood and traveling the world has given her some interesting insights into education, and she'll share them with us a little later here on Washington Watch. Of course, this agenda has made its way to our college campuses as well, but guess what? The left is meeting resistance. Kristen Hawkins, president of Students for Life, will actually bring us some good news about the enthusiasm she is witnessing among young people who are passionate about protecting life and free speech on college campuses. So, a lot of ground to cover today on Washington Watch. So, if by chance you miss any of it on your way home, you got to stop and get a loaf of bread, a gallon of milk, well, you can find it all later archived at TonyPerkins.com. So, mark that down, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me at T Perkins. All right, we're going to start right in the classroom. And some of the things that are happening in California, we've talked about this. Karen England's been on the program before. We were discussing what had happened in school districts, in fact, in charter schools in California, where stuff that's happening in the classroom is totally, totally undermining the authority of parents and going against the values that they want their kids to be exposed to. And she's here today with us to share some of the latest information coming out of California. So, Karen, I'm going to start with you first. What's happening? You know, last time we had you on, we were talking about Rockland, California, where in a kindergarten classroom, a teacher was reading two children's books, advocating this whole thing of gender fluidity and I Am Jazz by the transgender reality TV star Jazz Jennings, and read a crown story about a blue crown that identifies as a red one. So this stuff is going on in California. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is the parents are continuing to fight back. The school, the charter school, has lost almost 100 kids just in the last few months. These families have left, but they are still fighting for other people's parental rights. And what has been happening is they did the transition ceremony. So they went beyond the book. In addition to reading the books, they had the little boy go into the restroom, change into a dress, come back out after they read one of the books, and introduced the little boy as his girl name and said he is a girl now. This was 2 days before graduation of kindergarten.
And did the parents know that this was going to happen in the classroom?
Not only did the parents not know, but when they were asking the school what happened, because their kindergartner, you know, is telling them stories, I had a pastor that said they thought their child was just talking about a play because they couldn't quite understand or grasp that the charter school would just do this. So he thought they were talking about this little boy dressing up. And it wasn't until months later and an open records request that we found out that they knew about it ahead of time. The administration knew the book was going to be read, and it was only months of pressuring the school. When the parents would call or send an email, they were told, we can't tell you what happened in the classroom because of privacy. That's what the parents were told.
But as parents yourself, as you organized, you actually requested the records and you found out and were able to connect the dots to see what led to this event.
Absolutely. Able to connect the dots, including the request that the parent made about her child wanting to become a boy. The mother admits this may just be a phase he's going through. We don't know if he's going to want to remain a girl. She introduced it that way, and the school still felt the need to do this whole ceremony, read this book, and traumatize the other kids and knowing that this kid, this could be a phase. And there are several references mm-hmm. from other elected officials, school board members that talk about, oh, there's a 50% chance he'll change back, she'll change back. But they
right.
put
well,
all
the,
these
we,
kids through this.
Yeah, we know that's a phase that they go through. Elizabeth Schultz, many parents out there facing very similar situations, especially when you've got these schools adopting these bathroom policies where boys can use girls' bathrooms and locker rooms and stuff. And parents are just saying, you know, what is going on? Parents are not helpless. I mean, you were a parent. You are a parent. But you were concerned about what was happening in your school district, and you did something about it.
Ironically, it was actually the Freedom of Information Act effort in a similar way, but on a totally different subject. The school board prior to the one that I was elected to had shut down my child's elementary school. And there was something that just didn't seem right, so members of the community submitted the Freedom of Information Act requests. And what we saw through those was the conduct of people who were elected to represent parents, to represent employees, and use the public's money for the public's benefit. And it was so appalling that I myself decided to run. In the time since then, all of this type of topic has emerged
right.
onto first the local scene in Fairfax and then explode nationally. And what you see is that you have the power as an individual parent, as an individual community member, if you don't like what you're seeing, you can bemoan your fate,
right.
or you can change the future. And becoming directly involved in harnessing that local power and bringing back a school district and bringing back a voice to say that parents' rights matter and parents' voices matter is significant enough to compel you to try to take back your school board.
But Elizabeth, isn't it the desire of many on the school board? I know you're in the minority. You're a conservative on the school board in Fairfax County. Isn't the reality of they want parents to think they can't make a difference? They don't. Many see the parents as a nuisance and an obstacle to overcome.
Well, that just happened on our Family Life Education Committee. Actually, I wasn't there, but the reports come back that We have a committee that's creating family life education material, curriculum. And parents are very few and far between as a representation on that committee. And they actually expelled one of the parents and continued to create part of a curriculum, changing the term sex through the FLE curriculum to sex assigned at birth. So we're now not going to take scientific knowledge, we're not going to take objective reality, we're not going to take natural law as truth. We're going to allow a group of people who don't represent parents to create the curriculum, and where is the place for a parent's voice anymore?
Mm-hmm.
So even if they're not actively not including them, they're working behind the scenes in such a way as not to inform parents. And parents are busy, they're exhausted,
right.
they're running, you know, their lives, their children's lives, their work. And the ability to communicate out to parents, look, not only do you have to pay attention, there's probably some stuff going on that you wouldn't be very happy with if you actually knew.
And so, Karen, you actually, some of these things you got to do a little digging. Of course, some of it's just asking your kids questions. And as you ask kids questions, because as you pointed out earlier, they thought maybe this was a play. They don't get all the pieces. But if you see something, I guess to borrow something from the TSA, if you see something, say something. I mean, this is where we must speak up.
Well, absolutely. And they spent, you know, as the one parent that sort of started this, The school district was denying that a book was even read. And so were school board members denying that it even took place for 2 months in emails, in every communication with these parents. And then parents were going back and asking their kids. And this one diligent mom was keeping track of every family she went to, what every child said, what was consistent, inconsistent. And I will say, I am so impressed with moms and dads at the local school district level. In everywhere that I'm working, they have become paralegals. I mean, they are looking at the law and they are splitting work up and they're babysitting each other's kids. And, you know, do not mess with their kids, because right. they've taken this very seriously. They've moved their kids and now they are committed to making sure this doesn't happen to any other kindergarten class in the state of California.
Right. And it's not even just young children. You know, when you're inculcating, we see what's happening on college campuses across the country, and everybody's very upset about that because it gets displayed
right,
on the
right,
evening news.
Right.
But the problem is we're giving primed children
right.
over to the colleges. And if you talk to, for example, your high schoolers, and all of a sudden their English class teacher at the beginning of the school year is saying, here's a form, and the form has all kinds of demographic information about you and your family and how you live and what's your preferred pronoun. We're doing that for everyone. So we're not now meeting the needs of an individual student with an individual issue that, you know, we want to have compassion about. Now what you're saying is we're going to change for everyone and inculcate a complete message so that we're delivering these primed children onto the college campuses.
I think it's an extremely important point that when you see what's happening at the school level, at the college level, that this didn't just happen. It didn't happen in a vacuum. It didn't happen overnight. But these kids, when they're acting out on college campuses, it is the result of what they've been exposed to for, you know, 13 years. And so this is, if you want to borrow a line from the great philosopher Barney Fife, you got to nip it in the bud. And if you want to stop this, you've got to do it at that level of elementary and secondary education. It's so critical.
Well, and the other side knows that, which is why they're getting all these different school committees, like Elizabeth was talking about, to make sure that they can change the curriculum. And often, you know, I'm finding out in other states, you know, a lot of people think it's just crazy California, but several other states where school administrators are just enacting these policies on their own.
All right, we got to take a break. We're up against a break, but we're going to come back with more of Karen and Elizabeth, because I want to transition to talking about what can be done. All right, we're not here just to raise people's blood pressure. We're to give them specific steps on how they can make a difference in the lives of their children. And I also want to touch on the fact that it's not just their children. It is the community, because we're all affected by the community that's created through our public education system. So folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. We're coming back with more of this special program focused on public education. Right after this, don't go away. We'll be right back with more in just a moment.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As Senior Director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Hear Mr. Arnakis discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. As I said this past weekend, I was at an event, the Council for National Policy, which I serve as president of. And one of the topics that came up was the issue of education. So I wanted to dig a little deeper and get some of the experts I know around the country that are involved in this issue to really go a little bit further on this, because I just think so many people are missing it. They don't know what's happening right under their noses. And so two of the experts that I know that we've had on the program before, Karen England, she's in California, also involved in Nevada with the school districts there, and Elizabeth Schultz, who's been on the program before, who is on the school board, actually, at Fairfax County. All right, Karen, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to go back to you. When you were talking about parents discovering what's happening in the classroom. And I'm using those words intentionally because you're going to have to do a little digging. But when you find out about it, what do you do?
Well, when you do need to do digging, that is the first thing, because the kids don't just come home. Sometimes this goes over their head. And we do have a checklist for both Nevada and California, and would work for anywhere, that parents can ask their children these certain questions to get them talking about different things that you can look through in the child's curriculum that will tip you off. But in addition to that, parents can be looking at their school handbook. You know, you get it the first day of school, and then, you know, you file it away because life just starts. And so you need to go through those policies that they send back. And if something doesn't sit right, like when Elizabeth said there just wasn't something right about the school closing, she started just digging a little deeper. And so find other like-minded parents, talk to them. If, you know, you still think there's a problem, I have to say that school officials don't always tell the truth, or school board members. And so you need to keep digging. But you can go online and look at the school policies. You can go online and watch a school board meeting if you don't have a babysitter. You can find out what's going on. And once you do, you then need to organize, educate yourself, call in groups that have done this before. And there's a lot of us, you know, we're on both sides of the coast, but they're all over depending on what state you're in. And we'll come in and we'll help you and assist you and walk you through this. I was a homeschool mom who got involved over a charter school in California, the 13th charter school. I was just a homeschool mom. And, you know, now I'm reading laws and all of it. It just happened. I got passionate and thought this is so wrong. we need to tell somebody. And I still feel that way 22 years later.
And Elizabeth, you passionate about the issue of education as well. And did you ever envision yourself being a school board member?
Never in a million years. And listen, I want to talk about the fact that there are 90,000 school board members in the United States, you know, running all of the school systems. And we think a lot that the answer for some people may be homeschool, or some people it's a charter or parochial or other kind of private school. The reality is that over 50 million children are in public schools. And there's the parents' voices of those children need to be represented. And it isn't in the PTA, to be perfectly honest. Yes, you're engaged in your local child, but that's not who's creating education policy. And so the ability to understand really what's happening in your community, the large portion of your local community's budget is probably in the schools. There's actually not a position that affects the daily life of most Americans more than the local school board members, and nobody's really paying attention to that. They think it's Washington that affects their lives. It's how your local money is spent for the local quality of life and what children are learning for 13 years. Those are our future doctors, lawyers, journalists. Mm-hmm. I mean, who do you want graduating from these, and what do you want them believing? And if you aren't paying attention to your local school board, you're really not going to have the ability to affect outcomes any more than if you look at your local school.
Well, my listeners know that I've said this many times. We personally homeschool. We've homeschooled all of our kids. I'm an advocate of homeschooling, but there's only about 1.8 million kids that are being homeschooled in America today. Private schools, probably another 6 million kids. That doesn't even stack up close to the 50 million that are in the public schools. Now, I personally am not for sending our kids into the public schools. I am for sending Christians in as teachers into our public schools and into our school boards, looking at them as missionaries of truth in those positions. And as you pointed out, it affects so much of our community, and it consumes so much of the resources that we have that if we use it wisely, we might be able to save money for other things. How difficult, Elizabeth, is it for someone to run for the school board?
Running for a school board is easy. Taking some of the abuse that you may get as a result of running, you got to have some thick skin. The unfortunate thing is that we were called, if you live as a Christian or if you live a Judeo-Christian philosophy, you're going to be under attack. But we were called to go into the world. Anybody can be a saint, you know, living in a cave on the side of a hill.
That's easy.
That's the difficult thing is to try to advocate for good policy, be an effective communicator, and say, you know what, even at my local school board, I'll be under attack, but children are worth it. The children are our future. And if our future is worth it and our children are worth it, then it's worth you entering into the fray.
And let me ask you both this question as we wrap up our time together. And I know both of you are Christians. You walk in humility. But by stepping into the void, your presence has made a difference. And one person can make a difference by being involved.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I was a homeschool mom, and just this last week, you know, I've got involved, and we've stopped the gender, transgender movement in Clark County, the fifth largest school district in the nation. We've pushed it back, and it's because we've gotten involved. And I want to encourage taxpayers to get involved, too, and homeschool parents to get involved, too, because these are our taxpayer dollars.
One person can make a difference.
One person. You can make a difference. You can treat people with Christian humility and understand that we need to respect where they're coming from. But if your voice isn't there, their voice will fill the void. And so if your voice is missing, somebody else's voice is going to raise your children.
Karen England, Elizabeth Schultz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking
us.
All right, folks, more to come. As I mentioned, this is all the way onto college campuses, as was pointed out. But there's some good things happening because we're seeding the college campuses with conservatives and Christians who are speaking truth. So when we come back, we're going to be talking with Kristen Hawkins, Students for Life. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay. Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue. If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you got it, at T Perkins. All right, I'm joined now by one of my favorite pro-life leaders. She is president of Students for Life, Kristen Hawkins. Since launching the Students for Life, their full-time operation, Kristen has helped more than triple the number of campus pro-life groups in the United States. In addition to launching their unique nationwide field program, Kristen and her team have launched Med Students for Life, Law Students for Life, and on these college campuses. And it's really kind of a transformative initiative which strives to connect young women in need on college campuses, and that's actually their, is it called the pregnant students?
Pregnant on campus.
Pregnant on campus. Now, that's an interesting one. Kristen, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
We were just discussing in the earlier segment about what's happening in elementary and secondary education and how we're actually seeing the fruit of that on many of our college campuses, years of indoctrination. But there's actually some good things as pro-life, young pro-life conservatives are hitting college campuses. Many of them are being emboldened when they come into association with, like, Students for Life to speak up.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, some of these students, they've been raised in a Christian or a pro-life home, but some of them haven't. And some of them have never actually experienced living with a Christian worldview. And it's kind of shocking for those of us who have. But we've given them an opportunity by going to campuses, and we present this as a very simple human rights issue. Is this wrong? Is this violence? How is this helping anyone? And students, they understand science. They've seen the ultrasounds of their brothers and sisters in the womb. They know, obviously, abortion kills a unique, living, whole human being that's never existed before and will never exist again. And so they're like, yeah, I want to stand up against that injustice. What can I do? And so we're able to kind of give them something to get involved. And I think that that's one of the challenges with young people is there's so many things that they're overwhelmed with and on Facebook and Twitter, all of these injustices that they see. But we want to move them from just saying, yeah, that's wrong, to I want to be a part of that movement. I want to do something. And that's the value of organizing with Students for Life groups in high schools and colleges across the country.
But now you've seen some in the realm of the faculty that may not be as welcoming to this this wave of pro-life activism.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we've had this issue for years. Obviously, this is not a new issue. We have seen an increase, though, I would say, since President Trump has been sworn into office, of basically suppression of free speech on campuses, where, you know, we have students who've applied to have a Students for Life group and they're rejected, or their application gets lost for 10 months and no one can find it. And so we have to file lawsuits ensuring the freedom of speech of pro-life students on these campuses, and we win. I mean, this is very simple.
Right.
It's right there in the Constitution.
Yeah.
I mean, we have other vandalizations that happen where, you know, we have Cemetery of the Innocents displays, where we have crosses representing children who've been aborted, and those crosses are tore up, they're smashed, they're thrown away. So we have to be on our guard. And, you know, we filed more lawsuits this year than we've ever filed. We've won more cases than we've ever won. The good news is we have still protections. When we take these issues, these vandalizations, these free speech cases to court, we win. But we've got to, you know, embolden these students to stand up and stand up for their rights.
And that's what I want to focus on, because the law is on our side.
Sure.
The Constitution is on our side. We have the right to speak. We have the right to bring this viewpoint to college campuses. But there is clearly bullying on the left, on the side of many administrations on these college campuses. But let me ask you this about the young people today, because when I was on college campus 30 years ago, you know, a long time ago, you know, back in the Stone Age, I would walk by Free Speech Alley and listen occasionally, but I'm not one that was always very vocal, even though I shared that worldview. Do you see an increase in the number of young people who have that worldview that are willing to stand up and speak, even in the face of this growing opposition?
Absolutely. And actually, the more opposition they face on the campuses, the more emboldened they are. You know, many of our team members who work for us throughout the country, starting Students for Life groups, empowering and equipping these student leaders, they've come to us as students who tried to start a Students for Life group on their campus, who were spit at, who were yelled at, who faced, you know, discrimination because of their beliefs by their professors or their administration. The more opposition a Students for Life group faces, the stronger it will be and the stronger its leaders will be. Actually, my biggest concern are in the states where no one wants to talk about abortion. It's impolite to bring it up. That's actually where we face some of our biggest challenges organizing students. And we have to push this conversation, because we realize this is where the abortion industry targets. 79% of Planned Parenthoods are 5 miles from college campus. This is where hearts and minds are being formed about this issue right there on campus. So we have to push this conversation. So it's better for us to have a group and face opposition, for us to not even be able to get a group started because no one wants to talk about abortion.
How can young people that are headed to college campuses, you know, coming up next fall, or they're already there, how can they connect with you?
You go to studentsforforlife.org, and this is high school, college, homeschool, all students. We've got needs for you.
There's room for everybody.
Yeah, there is. There's room for everyone.
Well, folks, I can't think of a better organization, young people to join, or parents to direct your kids to. Look, if you're going to send them off to school, send them off with a mission to be educated, but also to make a difference. We all have a purpose and a passion, and when you can bring those two together, it's a powerful combination. And so our purpose, as I teach my kids from the Westminster Catechism, Shorter Catechism, is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And there's no better way to glorify God than to speak up for the sanctity of human life. Kristen Hawkins, as always, great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, don't go away. We're coming back right after this with more with Sam Sorbo. Stay tuned.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for joining us on this Monday afternoon. The website is tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. All right. I'm thrilled now to be joined by another amazing woman on today's program, Sam Sorbo. She is a radio host, actress, author, wife, mother, and here's the best. She is a homeschooling advocate. All right. She is actually a homeschool mom who is empowering other moms to homeschool.
Yeah. Parents, other parents to homeschool. Right. There is a small contingent of fathers that homeschool.
Well, look,
as well.
I have always been the superintendent
of our
homeschool operation. They get sent to the principal's office.
My husband's the gym teacher.
Yeah, the kids won't keep up with me on that. They say I'm too hard. So when I make them do push-ups, they just don't like it. But before we get into that, I want to share a little bit of your story to put this in context for our listeners. You studied biomedical engineering at Duke University before pursuing a career in modeling. Now, modeling offered the opportunity to travel and learn languages. In fact, we were just talking about you're fluent in 5 different languages,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, I like language.
Do you?
Yeah. But I'm a mathematician.
You are.
And,
so
you do
2 things that I don't do at all.
We used to be taught that if you liked math and science, at least this is what I grew up with, if you like math and science, then you're not really a linguist. You're not really good with language. You're not going to write good papers, and you're not into the humanities. And I think nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, that's one of the lies that I really want to dispel. It took me a long time to figure out that I was a writer.
Really?
It was not until after I left college, and now I'm a writer. So I think that we've bifurcated our education to the degree that it's a lie that we're really doing a disservice to children in schools when we teach them subjects.
And it's only getting worse.
Of course.
Under the Common Core curriculum and a lot of the initiatives to drive them on a certain path rather than what parents are designed to do as God created the family is that a parent who spends time with their child understands the passion and the abilities of that child and even sees the God-given calling upon the life of that child to then nurture it, bring it forward, and groom them for the calling that God has for them, rather than some bureaucrat sitting in some windowless office in Washington, D.C.
Well, the thing that really bothers me is that we've gotten to the point where we are so on the treadmill of, you got to put your kid in school, kindergarten. At the age of 5, suddenly the parent becomes an appendage and no longer necessary, whatever, and so it's time to send your child to school. And we have to get away from that paradigm, because you take your child to school and you're not allowed to know who the teacher is until the day before. Why? Because they don't want to hear any flack from the parents, because the parents are busy checking out, okay, who's the best teacher, what's the teacher that is most popular, whatever. They only post the teachers the day before, because you better sit down and behave. And we don't want any flack from you parents, because we're in charge now.
Right. And that's what we're taught to do. We're taught to sit down and listen, because they're the authority figure.
That's right.
You know, I don't want to offend any of our listeners here, but I may with this story. I was a television reporter a number of years ago, and did a story on homeschooling. I'd never been exposed to it.
Right.
I interviewed a family that I've now known for many years. In fact, one of the 5 kids in the family, he was 12 years old at the time, went on to be a chief of staff for the governor of Louisiana and very involved now in politics. But I did that story, and it was on socialization, and it just showed that these kids are very well socialized. That's been backed up by so many different studies that they are socialized. But I went home, I told my wife, and we at the time, I think our oldest daughter was 3 years old. I said, hey, we ought to try this homeschool. And her reaction was not positive. She said, I am not wearing a blue jean jumper, and I'm not going to get into that mode that we thought that.
Yeah, the whole stigma.
Yeah.
Right.
But it was that, what prompted me to think of that was the day, it was like a week before she was going to be put on the bus to go to kindergarten, my wife said, what do you think if we homeschooled?
Wow.
And so I said, hey, if you want to homeschool, we'll homeschool.
Right.
So it was that when that whole idea of reality hit, that we were going to be putting our 5-year-old daughter on the
bus to,
to be carried off somewhere.
To meet strangers that you have no idea about. But we trust them, because why? The government tells us that they're accredited, or the unions tell us that they're accredited. And I'm hoping that we see a little bit of a distrust now that's coming through.
We should. All that's happening in the classroom. Now, you talked about being a writer, and you actually wrote a book just a couple of years ago. It is a book about homeschool.
Right.
They're Your Kids, An Inspirational Journey from Self-Doubter to Homeschool Advocate. What do you mean by self-doubter?
I didn't think I could. I was convinced that I didn't know how.
But you were a graduate from Duke University.
You would wonder
you
why.
You speak 5 languages.
I felt inadequate to teaching a 3rd grader.
Why?
Because I went to public school.
And
this is what we are taught in public schools, is that we are not adequate to do anything that we haven't been specifically instructed by a teacher at a blackboard. Right? I didn't have the letters after my name that indicated that I had some sort of doctorate or whatever in early childhood education or whatever. And so I thought I was inadequate. And this is what I say to parents who say, oh, I could never do that. I don't know how. But you graduated from public school. Yeah, yeah. But you're going to send your child back into the system that turned out you. And it's likely worse now than it was when you graduated. And yet you feel incapable of educating a 3rd grader. And that was me. And what I learned is that you don't have to know everything.
So you learned that you're smarter than a 5th grader.
Well, it's true that I am. And my children darn well know it. You don't have to know everything. You need to be the lead learner. So when your 5-year-old comes to you and says, Mommy, why are frogs green? I don't know why frogs are green, but
you
we
teach
have the internet
them, you
now.
You teach them how to find out.
That's
it happens
right.
every day in
That's
our house.
Right.
Actually, it happens when we're driving down the road. A question's come. I don't know. Let's find out.
Now, and here's the kicker. We are living in a time now where everything is changing so quickly. One of the presentations I just heard was that, the disruptive elements that we're seeing now a year before they like blew up, no one had ever heard of them. Things are changing so quickly. You need to be raising children who are lifelong learners, yeah. not children who have come out of an institution where their learning has been sort of capped at, okay, you've graduated now, you never need to take another test or whatever. We need to be raising kids who say, gee, I want to change careers, because they will. And how am I going to do that? Oh, I know, I'll just Google, you know, what I need to know, and then I'll learn it, and then I'll go and do it. And that, and honestly, that was what formed this country. That's what made this country as prosperous as we were. We didn't know how to do anything when we first landed, yeah. but we got it done.
You had to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. My guest is Sam Sorbo. She is married to Kevin Sorbo. Together, they are making movies, writing books, and impacting the culture. I want to go back again on this issue of from self-doubt to right. to being a homeschool mom, because I hear that a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Because we've been indoctrinated to not believe in ourselves.
But there's so many resources out there today as
right.
well.
Right.
So that's not like you're embarking upon some kind of thing as a pioneer.
No.
I mean, you've got so many
and organizations. I do classical conversations. They're very supportive. If there are people who are listening who are at least contemplating, who are open to the idea, what they need to do is just go right online and find a homeschool group. Homeschoolers are very embracing. They want to encourage everybody. And it doesn't even, politics doesn't enter into it. Religion doesn't enter. They just want people to know that you can keep your children at home and you can cement the family bond. Because as we know, the school, whether it's on purpose or inadvertently, the school forms a wedge between the child and the parent. And the school undermines the authority of the parent with the child. And so when you have a teenager who's rebelled, it's no wonder the teenagers
right.
rebel. They've been taught their whole lives that the school has the authority and the parent has none. And so I'm trying to kind of stand that on its head. That's my goal. The other part of my goal is I wrote a book this past summer called Teach from Love, which is a school year devotional. And initially I was thinking I was writing it for homeschoolers, but then I decided, who really needs to learn about virtue and godly characteristics?
True.
But kids who are in school, I don't know where else they're going to learn it, because an hour of church a week isn't going to do it. I mean, the church is facing an 82% attrition rate from young people. We need to keep people in the faith and bring them up in the faith and teach them. And, you know, there should be no objection from people who don't believe in God, because people who don't believe in God but live in the United States, by and large, believe in godly characteristics, believe in virtue. And virtue is what made this country. Because without virtue, none of our laws mean a darn thing. Because there's no reason to obey the law if you don't believe in virtue, right? You're just in it for yourself and you do whatever you want. And we've already seen what that turns out, the
Absolutely.
Likes of Harvey Weinstein.
The issue of moms taking parents, all right, but in most
yes,
cases the
moms.
Burden falls to the mom. So I'm just being realistic
yeah.
here. It's a daunting task when you think about, oh man, am I going to have to teach this kid from now until they graduate
no.
from high school?
Yes, you don't.
What we did, I want to know if you did the same thing. What we just said 1 year at a time.
I did worse than that. I said just for the fall. When I started. Well, the school basically did not serve my child, so I needed to try something else. I was very frustrated, and so I said to Kevin, I just want to try it for the fall. I just want to see. And I tried it. I found some career. I did a bunch of research. I joined a homeschool group, and I tried it, and it was magical. It was magnificent. First of all, I didn't have to answer to the school. I didn't have to get up at the crack of whatever.
Yeah.
And put your shoes on, get your bag, why aren't you ready yet? You know, all of that, I skipped all that. I didn't have to make the lunch for the paper bag. I didn't have to leave it at home and then turn around and drive home and get it for the, you know. I skipped all that. So it was very freeing. And then the relationship with my children became so much stronger. And the relationship of my children to each other grew and became much more cemented and more beautiful. I mean, it was just an amazing transformation. And so I kind of never looked back. I certainly never considered putting them back in public school. I did try a small Christian school for a short while because I still felt inadequate. I thought that I was failing them. And I thought I was just really not getting the job done. And it turned out I was getting it done really well. But at that point, I'd already tried the Christian school. And I went, okay, so... I don't get down on teachers, though. I think teachers are wonderful.
I was just talking about this in a previous segment, that I actually, while I do not advocate Christians putting their kids in public schools, I advocate Christians teaching in our public schools, because I think we need that presence. I don't want to give up on our public schools.
No.
I'm just not going to sacrifice my kids to the public schools.
Yeah.
And I have found, to your point about the bonding, we have such close relationship with our kids. Conversations that, you know, I'm close to my parents. I got great parents. But I didn't have those conversations with them because, you know, I was in the public schools.
Right. They were sending you off for those conversations.
And these days, those
conversations don't happen in the public. Maybe before they did, but they don't happen. And even if you're a Christian teaching in a public school, you can't have that conversation. Right. You're forbidden from having that conversation. I mean, it's kind of a dangerous sort of road that we're walking right now with everything that's going on.
They've tried to completely exclude any type of moral. You, as George Washington said in his farewell address, don't think that you can have morality without religion. And what we've tried to do is separate the idea that we can have virtue and we can have morality without religion. There's no foundation for it.
Although I'd push back and say we have religion. It's called irreligion, and it comprises...
But the virtue and the morality with that is the opposite
is
of what we
of
want.
Fittest.
Absolutely.
Right.
So if we want to have a society that is moral, that respects women, that we don't have to see this hashtag MeToo, you've got to have that religious content, which is being excluded, in fact, barred from our public schools.
Right. It's true. And I'm surprised that there isn't a little bit more outrage from the parents. I would like to see a little moral righteousness or, you know, something. But I think that they're not really aware of all the transformations that are happening. I do want to talk quickly about my movie, Let There Be Light, which comes out on DVD at the end of the month, but it's available for pre-sales on Amazon right now. So if you want to get the DVD of Let There Be Light, and if you want to bring it to your church, go to faithfilmsnetwork.com, faithfilmsnetwork.com, and you can bring it to your church for free, and it can be a fundraiser for your church. Try to say that five times fast.
Well, say it again.
Okay. Faithfilmsnetwork.com as a fundraiser for your church.
So a church can, like, show this on a Saturday night, Friday night.
Yeah, make a movie night, and also as outreach, right? Because the film is very it's very much of an outreach film. It's a good film. We screened it
at the Values Voter Summit last year. It is a great movie.
And so you can, if you're afraid to invite somebody to church, which I think everybody kind of is these days, it's sort of testy to invite someone to church, invite them to a movie at your church.
We've done this at our church. Where we've had these type of events, we do concerts and stuff, just to so the community knows we're there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when they feel like, you know what, I need more, my kids need more, they know exactly where to go.
Right.
Sam Sorbo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah,
and,
I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to encourage folks to go to the website, tonyperkins.com, follow the links over, and it's a great opportunity to bring your church beyond the walls, really, tear down the walls, and invite the community in to see the movie.
By the way, we're also organizing a trip to Israel, sorboisraeltrip.com. I'm so excited.
That should be interesting.
My kids are old enough now to go, so it's a family trip to Israel, walking in the footsteps of Jesus.
Now, you've got another movie in the making, right?
Yeah, a couple.
I
just did one called Bernie the Dolphin. My husband is one of the stars of the movie. I just played a little part.
Is he the dolphin?
He doesn't play the dolphin.
Oh, okay. All right.
He plays with the dolphin.
Okay. All right.
It's a family film.
All right. Folks, I want to thank you all for joining us. Sam, thanks for being with us today. Folks, let me encourage you once again with the words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. Again, that's 1-866-372-7234. 372-7234.